I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today on The Larry Mueller Show. It's Technology Monday, and we're talking about artificial intelligence today, AI, the good and the bad, what we've seen so far and what's still possible ahead. Our guest is Kyle Cranmer. He's UW-Madison professor in the physics department with affiliate appointments in computer sciences and statistics. He's also director of the Data Science Institute at UW-Madison. So what questions do you have about this AI technology? How have you seen it used so far? And what do you think about the ways it could be used going forward? You can join our conversation at any time at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us anytime, talk@WPR.org. And Kyle, welcome to the Larry Mueller Show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's start with a little bit of under the hood and what it means when we're saying artificial intelligence and what goes into making an artificial intelligence that we see today or is being employed as AI models. What does the AI mean?
Yeah, AI has a long history. The term was first coined in like the 1950s, so it's been around for a long time. And I think it's not a surprise, AI has been part of like sci-fi movies and public knowledge and sort of pop science and et cetera for a long time. But we're certainly seeing something very different happening since since 2022 or so with these large language models and things like ChatGPT. There's a little bit of the modern AI that we're seeing right now is a very specific set of capabilities. And the AI that was used in the 1950s was a very broad concept. And so through the decades, we've seen, a few milestones and certain capabilities and things like that. But certainly what's happening recently is very interesting and certainly has the public's attention.
Large language models. Is that what we're using with contemporary artificial intelligence?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think those are so ChatGPT is that, and that's the most well-known thing. But then kind of a hop, skip, and a jump away, our ability to generate, for instance, images or audio and things like that. And they're related to some of the same developments. So it's not just language, but sometimes people talk about the ability to generative AI, the ability to generate things like text or generate a new image or sound or something like that. That's kind of the most recent capability.
What about the ability to process?
Yeah, so I think it will be important to think about AI oftentimes in terms of like automation. It sort of removes some of the mysticism around, what's going on and some of the sci-fi, mm-hmm. Overly loaded terminology. Automation may be a little bit more boring, but something we're used to, and a lot of what's happening in society is maybe better just thought about in terms of automation, but AI is allowing us to automate things we didn't know how to automate before.
So automation and generation seem to be the two key categories with our current artificial intelligence models.
I think so, yeah.
You're the director of the Data Science Institute at UW-Madison. Tell us a little bit about how you see AI through this role.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a lot of we have sort of the two sides, like you said in the intro, the good and the bad. We're primarily focused on the good part, like what is it that we can use AI to accelerate science? There's all sorts of great things that can be done in terms of, say, for finding new materials that might be useful for sequestering carbon from the atmosphere or accelerating all sorts of areas of science for drug discovery and things like that, that I think have positive impact on society. And I think that people would generally like to see. But a lot of those same tools can be used either for fun, making images of teddy bears on skateboards or something like that. Or they can be used to do, nefarious things like write scam emails at a scale that we've never seen before. So it's tricky. So we do, with the Data Science Institute, also have the part about thinking very, critically about the impact on society and those things. So we try to take a balanced approach.
And yet this technology is the toothpaste out of the tube, right? There's no going back. But are there ways to control it? Are there ways to regulate it or rein it in?
That is a good question. I mean, it's certainly a hot topic. We saw that with the Big Beautiful Bill that there was one of the provisions
yes.
that was debated about. So there had been, certainly in Europe, there's been a lot of activity to try to sort of pump the brakes a little bit and put the layers of regulation. Of course, a lot of the lawmakers aren't experts, and so sometimes they're a bit clumsy about how they go about doing it. And you want to avoid sort of you know, stopping what could be like a, you know, great progress and that might have positive economic impacts or help us realize the positive side. But at the same time, it's changing very rapidly and there's so much room for something negative to happen that, you know, I think it makes a lot of sense for there to be common sense regulation there. And so there was some talk about just stopping all regulation for up to 10 years. And the 10-year time horizon is almost impossible to imagine what's going to happen. So that seemed like not a great idea. So I think that was removed, which is good to see, I think.
Kyle Cranmer, our guest, he is the director of the Data Science Institute, and we're taking a look at artificial intelligence. I'd also be interested, as we're told, to conserve energy and to keep our air conditioners at a reasonable temperature, how energy is being used for processing and whether or not, as you mentioned, teddy bears on skateboards are the best use of these huge processing centers, or if there is an investment in energy that we could make where we'd see benefits like new pharmaceuticals and new technologies that we can't even dream of on our own.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The energy use and also water use are both things that are really important. So it's a little tricky because so much of our lives lives in the kind of digital world these days,
right?
And all these kinds of, you know, cloud-based services. So we're using energy for all sorts of things that we do, and this is adding to that. But it's also true that the AI types of applications are quite energy intensive. So it's not just a growth. I mean, it's really changing.
It's a spike.
It's a spike. So it's something that we need to worry about. And as they're rolling out more data centers and communities and things like that, that can have. It's such a large energy consumer. It can change electricity prices.
Ooh.
And then also these data centers are to cool them off, you use a lot of water basically as part of the air conditioning systems, and that can have impacts on the water resources that depends on the data type of data center and where you are. If you have, like for Arizona and things like that, that's a real concern.
Yeah, it's a debate I don't think I've heard. It was not part of that big, beautiful bill in terms of regulations and stuff, as far as I know. And I really haven't heard anybody talking about the investment that we're making in energy and water and the outcome we're getting in artificial intelligence.
That's right. Yeah. And I think, in some sense, you would hope that that would be priced into the services and things like that. So to the extent that there's energy use or water use, you have to pay for that, and somehow you should see that. So if it's that intensive, you might just think it would be really expensive. And
mm-hmm.
And to some extent, that's true. But on the other side, in this stage right now, there's a lot of people that are really investing and sort of, subsidizing or underwriting things to try to get in early. So you're not necessarily seeing
the true cost,
right?
The true
cost, yeah.
We're seeing investment up front, and that means that the true cost would probably be to come?
I think so, yes.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And as you mentioned before, a 10-year timeline is not reasonable considering how advanced and accelerating this technology is. So it's hard to say when that bill could come due.
Yeah. So I think, and it's interesting because you look at in Tennessee and Nashville, they have a lot of worry about, music, the music industry. And so people's voices, and, maybe we'll hit on music more later, but they passed some early legislation to try to protect, voices of their, mm-hmm. And to really try to protect that industry. So it was very much, it wasn't worrying about, some more like Terminator style, end of the world scenarios. It was a very business minded, let's protect this industry that's so important for us. So to say that that state couldn't enact such a regulation to seems kind of wrongheaded. And I think that's partially why you saw kind of bipartisan pushback on that provision.
Yeah, and also because we don't know where this technology is going to go.
Absolutely.
But when you mentioned the artificial intelligence creating art, I think about, what artificial intelligence being used to do the things that we would like the time to be able to create ourselves versus using artificial intelligence to do the things that would give us the time to create those things ourselves.
Yeah.
And how it is that we're seeing AI being the artist and us being stuck with it.
We're still doing the laundry and the dishes. And, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I would much rather the roles be reversed.
And is that a possibility going forward, or is that something that's sort of baked into the way AI is being rolled out right now as you see it, Kyle?
I don't think it's intrinsic. I don't think it's baked in that way. I mean,
okay.
Of course, once you have those capabilities, people are going to explore that space, and it's fascinating to see. And it's useful, if you want to make an image, that's like for your poster for your bake sale or something that gets people's attention. I mean, it's something you would like to do. And if you had those skills, you would use them. And you know, most people don't have the money to hire a graphic designer to do that. But you know, you know the clip art. I mean, you have clip art and and Photoshop and these things. There's a long history of that. But at the same time, it's so good that, you know, for graphic designers, you know, it's definitely a worrisome time. And but it, that extends to, you know, it's not there right now, but soon you'll have areas like, you know, architects and things like that that are going to be feeling the pressure as well.
This is something that came up with the CEO of Anthropic. I believe that's the company that runs the AI Claude. Is that right?
That's right.
And the CEO told Axios.com that he expects 10 to 20% in the next 1 to 5 years of white collar jobs to be eliminated, that they could lose one in five jobs over the next 5 years.
Yeah, I think that it's going in that direction. I think the time scale I don't really agree with, but you know, like I people are going to want to see these things work in a more trustworthy way. And even if everything worked perfectly, I think society moves a little bit slower than that. There might be some startups that try to take advantage of it quickly, and there might be some successes, but I
well, this CEO is one of those that's invested in this and subsidized it and has a vested interest in pushing this forward.
Definitely drinking his own Kool-Aid. I mean, with all respect to Dario and company at Anthropic, I mean, I know people there and they're doing great work. And it is moving in that direction. I do think that it will take longer for society to adapt. But then where is it going? And to what degree will it be AI-assisted, you know, people doing this work and just much more, you know, efficiently, or to what degree people are going to be, you know, looking for jobs. I do think it's definitely going to have an impact on the job market. I think that's clear. I don't think that you'll see entire areas completely disappear, because at least for a while, because it's going to take a while before there's trust that you can replace that.
So much like the debate over energy and water usage, this does not seem to be a debate that I've seen recently about artificial intelligence and where it's going and what happens when it starts taking so many jobs that would be entry level, that would be white collar, and what that would mean for our economy.
Yeah, I think there's no consensus. I mean, you see universities certainly taking various steps to try to, you know, preemptively prepare for what to do. You see, you know, I think people certainly talk about that it's going to have an effect on jobs, but without a lot of, you know, specifics about exactly what that's, but no one knows, right?
I
mean, it's and then some people are like, oh, don't worry, you know, we've done these things before.
Technology will find a way.
Right. And I think the right answer is going to be some mix of those things, and no one really knows. And it's going to be messy. I mean, it's going to have that kind of restructuring of society at some level is never not messy, but it's hard to predict.
So it's like the industrial era, the advent of the industrial era, the start of the information age. We are at the advent of our artificial intelligence era.
Yeah, I don't think it's hyperbole to say that it's that scale, for sure.
Yeah. Kyle Cranmer, our guest, he is a director of the Data Science Institute and professor in the physics department at UW-Madison. We're talking about artificial intelligence today and want to know what questions you have for our guest at 1-800-642-1234 and how these large language models are being used now and could be used in the future. You can also email us, talk@WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you're listening to WPR News. Coming up at noon, we talk about maps with Matthew Edney, the longtime director of the History of Cartography Project at UW-Madison. That's afternoon on The Larry Mueller Show. Right now, our guest, Kyle Cranmer, the director of the Data Science Institute at UW-Madison, taking a look at the technology of artificial intelligence and inviting you into the conversation about where you've seen it in your own life, what questions about how it's being used, and how it may be used in the years, months, weeks to come. 1-800-642-1234 or talk@WPR.org. And Kyle, you were mentioning the credibility or the veracity of what artificial intelligence models may say, I guess you'd put it. And the term that I've heard used is hallucinations, that AI can hallucinate. Now, another way to put it is it just got it wrong, right? It's just sometimes outputting inaccurate information.
Absolutely, yeah. So I think that it's tricky, but you know what the language models are doing that's different than what we've seen before internally, but it's not so obvious in terms of, you know, as a user, you know, is that when you used to ask a question to, for instance, Google, it would go out into the internet and try to find some source mm-hmm. that usually some human wrote. And, you know, that source, of course, could be wrong as well. And over the last decades, we've learned kind of, you know, as a society about how to sort of spot, you know, more trustworthy sources or not. But at some point, you know that there is someone who wrote it and who is asserting that that's true, and maybe believe it or not. But these language models, they've somehow consumed all this text on the internet. And it's basically like, if you had a person with a really, really good memory
yeah.
and you asked them a question, and they would basically do their best to recall what it was that they had read. But they might be wrong. And also, if there's the parts they don't really remember the details, if they're a really honest friend, they might be, I don't really remember this. But these language models, they don't say that. They just keep going. So, you know, my mental picture is it's a little bit more like a high school student that didn't do their reading. And they have...
But it's just taking a stab in the dark.
They've been called to go up in front of class and answer what this book was about. And they read chapter one and the last chapter in the liner notes, but they don't really remember the details. And so they're kind of making up the stuff in the middle. And so they... The language models, in some sense, have no shame. They're not trying to mislead you purposely, but they're just filling in the gaps with whatever seems like a plausible answer. And to the extent that they have a good memory, they're doing a very good job. And then in places where their knowledge is a little bit unclear, they'll just kind of fill in the details. But you can't tell, and that's the problem. That's what people call hallucinations. And you see it sometimes, people have used this for like case, like lawyers have used this.
Oh,
and they'll
yes.
just make up case law and cite it. Or you can ask it a scientific question, and sometimes it will just make up a reference to a scientific paper that doesn't exist. And
NPR had a story just last week about the CEO of MyPillow, Mike Lindell's attorneys being fined $3,000 each because of legal filings that they used that had clearly inaccurate, actually cases that did not exist,
exactly.
citing cases that didn't exist, and evidently it was artificial intelligence that played a role in that.
Yeah, exactly. And so you see things like that, which are very hard to spot, and they look authoritative. There's other examples that have, in the early days of them rolling out these kind of language models as part of Google search, you would ask questions like, how do you get your cheese not to slide off your pizza? And
it
said, oh, you should put some glue on there. And things like, it's recommended that you eat a few rocks a day because it's got minerals and things like that. So
can't you program shame, though? Or is that just a human thing that we can't teach large language models?
I think you've got a good grant application there. Yeah, shame is all you need. There are various people trying to figure out how to address this problem. Some are trying to look for, it's a fairly fundamental issue for how these work, unfortunately. So either you need to go to a very different paradigm, and that's difficult to come up with a totally new paradigm that would still perform as well as what we're seeing, but not have these problems, or you have essentially engineer some sort of, hack or fix around it, but that's a little bit like a Band-Aid. And so there's a lot of Band-Aid solutions that are happening right now. So sometimes for those that have tried to use ChatGPT, sometimes you'll get a response like, I can't answer that question, or you say like, make me an image of, Superman doing something, and it's like, oh, that's against some policy. Those are all kind of engineered solutions on top to stop the AI from doing the thing. The AI can do it. So someone had to kind of engineer a protection around it.
Tell them not to do it. Don't yeah. do this because you're not going to get it right.
Right. But then you get into an arms race of essentially people trying to, it's almost like lock picking or something. Like, how do I get around that? And then, you just layer protections on top of that.
Well, my understanding of basic computer science, Kyle, is garbage in, garbage out. So would there be a way to control what goes into a large language model that would help limit the sort of, and I would think maybe academic research would be one area where you could use peer-reviewed science as large language models in order to limit hallucinations from the AI.
Yeah, absolutely. No, so for sure, the performance of these things has everything to do with what data you use to train them on, but they are using as much of the academic literature as they can. Interestingly, there's all sorts of copyright issues there as well. Like for instance, a lot of the language models have been gone into like the New York Times. There's lawsuits about you were using this copyrighted material when you weren't supposed to. So a lot of that is still being litigated. And then there's questions if that's fair use and things like that. But But that information is there, but you also have a lot of this text of, you know, message boards on the internet that's filled with a lot of vile hate speech and things like that. So yes. It's all going in there. And then there's various approaches to, after you sort of consume all this data and you so-called train one of these models to, people use the term fine-tune it, to try to be a little bit more well-behaved or to give responses that people like better. But that's also all in the eye of the beholder, right? So who's in control of the material that you say is correct, and, you know, what behavior is the desired behavior? And the people that, there's very few people that have the resources to do it. And if they're calling the shots to adjust the properties of these, of course, it's going to go in a certain direction that's not necessarily for the benefit of everyone.
Kyle Cranmer, our guest, director of the Data Science Institute at UW-Madison. And I've asked enough questions here, and you've got some of your own, so let's go right to them at 1-800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org. We'll start with John in Madison. John, good morning.
Hi. I had a question about the use of machine learning or artificial intelligence by the military. It seems like there would be very strong incentives for the military to use as much as possible of machine learning, maybe to the detriment of society as a whole.
Hmm. Military and artificial intelligence, Kyle.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely a kind of technology that has sort of obvious applications, and there are definitely worries about how that can go. This is also a place where that rethinking about it in terms of automation is also often helpful. So, you know, you can have dumb automated devices like landmines. They're automated. They have all sorts of problems associated to them. And then you can have more sophisticated automated devices. And of course, there are, when you start thinking about like drones and automated things. And so, there's been some time of like, okay, well, maybe that's assisting, but in the end, there's a human that's calling the shots. And that's already an ethical enough issue. But then when you start going to the point where you have automated decisions, especially lethal decisions, you're definitely even going further. These kinds of tools can do facial ID very well. There's you have all the components to have a highly automated very lethal force. And at times there have been, groups of researchers that have signed on to PACs saying that, we won't do something for, that's going to support that. And so the community, I think, as a whole is quite aware of it. At the same time, for instance, in the Ukraine, you start to see, there are various examples, both in what's happening in Israel and Gaza, where you start seeing more kind of AI-assisted things. I mean, certainly drones are, in Ukraine are happening much more. So we are on the precipice of that, and certainly the new administration has been fairly vocal about, wanting to try to take advantage of these in the military context and things like that. So it's certainly something that everyone should be aware of and form their own opinions and, speak up and let your legislators know what you think.
We should be talking about where we would want our limits to be, because at the advent of this technology right now, there are very few to know.
Absolutely. Limits. Yeah. And there's the really on the nose kind of lethal military style things. And then there's also just like surveillance in general. And these technologies allow you to scale up at a level that we didn't know how to do before. And certainly you see, companies like Palantir and et cetera, that's their business model essentially is doing that. So,
and that's being used by the government
and that, yeah,
to some degree already.
Yes.
Great question, John. And thank you for asking. Let's go to Mark in Suamico next. Mark, you're on the Larry Mueller Show with Kyle Cranmer.
Hi, thanks a lot for the opportunity. So I've been hearing a lot about alignment lately. That's the concept that we want. Have the systems doing what we want them to do rather than going rogue on us. There's just a conference in the EU trying to figure out ways of doing so. And I repeatedly hear AI described as a tool, but I think of it more as an organism. And you can tell an organism what you want it to do, but it might have its own concept of what it wants to do. So I don't really see how it can be controlled.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a great question. I think, it has a lot to do with how you sort of design the systems. I mean, in the simplest way of saying it, at some point there's someone that's got a computer in front of them and they turn on this program that's running this AI, you know, model or something. And in some sense, it's as simple as just turning it off. You know, once you start having AI controlling the systems themselves, you know, it gets more complicated. And, you know, the way things are going with, you know, there's this talk right now, first language models came out where you could ask a question and it would respond. Now those are starting to learn how to use other kinds of tools. And one of the current waves of AI is so-called agentic AI, in the sense that you make agents, yep. AI agents that that know how to kind of operate cyberspace or increasingly like physical space. And those things, you know, if they're starting to, you know, run the data centers that have other AI things, it might start to be more difficult to turn them off or something. That's the kind of thing that people worry about. It's also the kind of thing that's probably the easiest to engineer to not happen.
Oh,
and
there's a solution.
Well, you know, I think, yeah, technically, if you just don't make such a system, you know, like that will help, or you have various kinds of fail safes. And it's also the kind of thing that from a regulatory point of view is maybe relatively easy to try to do. There are quite a few scientists that take this very seriously. So we talked about Anthropic earlier.
Yep.
And on one side, they're a company and they're making tools like Claude, which is a sort of like a ChatGPT thing, and they're trying to sell those services. On the other side, they're doing research and they talk a lot about the alignment issues and what happens if the AI starts to be smarter than us and how would we control it. And so these alignment questions is an academic research question they take seriously, and they do various kinds of experiments in little sandboxes to try to see what happens. So,
but we want it to be smarter than us. That's part of the power. We just don't want it to control us. That would be part of our disempowerment, right?
Exactly. And there's no consensus on this. I mean, you have very leading figures that have helped realize a lot of what we see around us that have very different opinions on this. So, so for instance, you know, there are three people that won some major prize, the Turing Prize, Jan LeCun, and Jeff Hinton, and Yashua Bengio, and the three of them have different stances on this issue. And some take it very seriously and really think we need a lot of regulation, but in a very even keeled way. Like, they're not saying that this is about to run out of control right now, but they're taking it seriously and like we should be careful. And others that think that that this is not a real problem and that it's trivial to design systems or you could just turn it off. But not everyone agrees on that.
Yeah. What does the director of the Data Science Institute at UW-Madison think?
I think that it's something that should be taken seriously and it should be an area for research. And there have certainly been some surprises. At the same time, as someone who tries to get these things to do what you want, it's so hard to get them to do what you want sometimes that like the idea that they're going to somehow like take over is seems very, very far away.
The Terminator Skynet scenario, yeah, the doomsday idea.
Exactly. But it's much better to be safe on this kind of thing. And also in terms of talking to society, at some point the gap, I mean, if your rationale for why you're not worried is too deeply rooted in your expertise and your experiences, at some point it's, people don't get it, right?
Yeah.
You know, and it's very hard to just say like, oh, trust me. So I think, you know, partially to maintain the trust of society, we need to say like, we're taking this seriously and these are the things that we're doing. And then people can feel maybe a little bit more comfortable that it's not completely irresponsible.
Thank you for the call, Mark. I appreciate that. And I'm glad we got a thoughtful answer about where we're going with it. And we are still going there. So this is a debate worth having, discussion worth in thinking about and coming up with what you would like to see, how you would like to see AI employed. We'll go to Nan in Madison next. Nan, good morning.
Hello. So my question is an extension of what you're just talking about. And excuse me, I see the two sides where let's not worry about it, let's worry about it. But are there any guardrails? Are there any, instead of sort of these two philosophical positions, is someone stopping the guy over in wherever he is deciding to see if AI can blow up the world or something?
Well, are there any guardrails for artificial intelligence at this point? You mentioned Tennessee having some to protect singer-songwriters.
Yeah. So there are you know, there are those kinds of regulations that are, you know, there's the development of the AI, and then there's kind of how it's being used, right? And that's one distinction a lot of people, you know, talk about in these kinds of technologies in general is, you know, developing the technology and then trying to regulate their use. Mm-hmm. Trying to regulate the development of the underlying technology, you know, there's a lot of people that are, you know, critical of that because it's the stifling innovation and where we might go. And if you don't think that that's the, you know, the real problem that you have right now, then maybe the downside of stifling innovation is worse than the, you know, than this threat that might be, you know,
there's a balance exaggerated.
And, yeah. And different people sit in different places. I mean, it is the short answer is very difficult because some of these AI models are being shared openly. And so if you have the know-how and you have some computational resources, you didn't even necessarily have to train them and have the resources to train one of these very powerful, say, language models. You can just take one off the internet and put it on your own computers, and then you can kind of you know, roll your own little service, and you can use that to do all sorts of things. So you could use it, for instance, to write, you know, scam emails and phishing and phishing attempts and things like that, or you could
seeing that now, right? I mean, that's what we're already seeing is people are making their own AIs, taking open source code online, harnessing it for their own purposes. And there aren't really no protections against that right now.
Yeah, it's very hard. And it's very hard to protect that. So that's the and also, like, if you see what's going on social media, a huge number of the accounts are not real people that are saying things. They're driven by, and so that's often not, you know, individual actors. It's a more organized kind of group, and you have a lot of misinformation that way. And so, so that's the thing that I'm much more worried about than the kind of Terminator scenarios. I mean, I do agree that having these things around weapons and, you know, things like that, and some these systems being able to be hard to turn off is, in principle, something we should be worried about. Like, in practice, it's very far away, I think, and it's not what keeps me up at night. The thing that keeps me up at night is a lot more about how you, right now, can, at scale, try to have conversations with people, with these AI models to try to...
You can scam an entire population.
Scam people, misinformation, all of those things. Yes. Also, even something that's not necessarily nefarious, but when people go to search for information right now, you type something, like the example I come up with is the Statue of Liberty about immigration. Very topical, you know, question. Yeah. And, you know, I certainly grew up that those are very connected, and that the Statue of Liberty is like a very American idea and is tied to America and its history is, you know, of being a nation of immigrants and et cetera. With where we are right now, that's a hot topic, right? And if you Googled for that and did a search, you would find all sorts of
opinions
and also, you know, documents and literature and articles from many years ago. And it would be hard to, you know, adjust that because the information is very distributed. But now when you type in Google, you get a kind of LLM assisted search. Or if you ask ChatGPT the same question, now you have one model that, like, some company controls, is giving you back what it thinks is the right answer. And it's much easier to intervene on that one model and change the answer to this question for everybody. So if someone wanted to say, no, actually, the Statue of Liberty has nothing to do with immigration. It was just, you know, France wanted to give us a gift or something like that, or I have no idea, you know, like, make something up. And the kind of revisionist history, you have like a single point of interaction. I'm much more worried about that.
Well, and that also appears to be something that is kind of happening now is the story of Elon Musk's AI, Grok, I believe, who at one point was considered too liberal in its responses, so they reined it in. And then most recently, it seemed to be giving anti-Semitic responses, so it reined it in. And the most recent story I saw about the AI came from the AP, which said the latest version of Elon Musk's artificial intelligence chatbot, Grok, is echoing the views of its billionaire creator, so much so that it sometimes searches online for Musk's stance on an issue before giving its own opinion. That seems like the smallest language model that we've used for AI so far.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think if you don't have transparency around how that's working... Mm-hmm.
But it also goes back to who controls these AIs and who we want to see at the reins, because that may have a lot to do with the outcomes that it creates.
Absolutely. And that's where you also see this difficulty. On one side, it could be a closed system in terms of how what kind of data was used to train this model, which reflects in some sense the kinds of answers you're going to expect. How did they adjust it or fine-tune it at the end to try to satisfy, you know, like what users or what experience are they trying to optimize for, right? You know, is it Elon Musk's answers or is it something else? But so you can have a company that does that and it's not transparent, or you could do that in a much more transparent and public way, which sounds good, but then you have the issue that now you're making these models public and then people can use them to do nefarious things. So it's, again, another balance to try to strike.
Brian in Madison wants to know more about the business model for these AI companies and how they expect to become profitable at some point.
That's a great question. I think that one of the I had a realization at one point when, you know, ChatGPT was first going and I was just playing around with it that, you know, it was so much nicer than the experience with a lot of Google search. And at some point I realized that it's not necessarily that the answers are better, but that I just get the answer. You know, like you ask a question and you get an answer. You don't get like 115 advertisements and sponsored things and you have to kind of go search through this very visually cluttered web page to try to find the information that you want. And then, you know, I started thinking about, well, why is that the case? You know, Google, of course, could strip out all the ads and not do sponsored things and just give you an interface so that when
but
you type
it. But that's the business
but
model.
But that's their business model, yeah. Right? And so then what's a business model for ChatGPT? And the business model right now is burn as much money as possible to try to get ahead with the idea that, you know, downstream you'll be in, you know, the number one company on this, and then you'll start to layer
incorporate
on
corporate sponsors.
I'm sure that all
which
that,
is similar to Google when it started with a search. It wasn't sponsor heavy. It was the reason it became the top, you know, search engine, and then it had to monetize. So when ChatGPT has to monetize, are we going to get more hallucinations that are going to ask us to buy more products?
I mean, that's a good question. I'm sure that, like, I don't know of that many examples right now, but I think it's like the business model just waiting to happen where you are kind of, you know, warping the answer from the kind of unvarnished language model thing to something that has some sponsored, you know, there's a Coca-Cola reference somewhere in there or something. But
I'm laughing, but I also at the same time, I'm like, I don't like the thought of that one bit. We just want the answer. ChatGPT just gives us the answer, but the answer comes packaged in a product somehow.
Right. So I think there's the whole class of things that are more search related, which I think you'll see a lot of similar business models. And then there's a lot of service related products. So you're starting to see, you know, ChatGPT you pay for, right? I mean, there's maybe a free version, but then for many of the nicer things you're paying for, there are tons of companies that are will pay for this service. And then they, for instance, don't want their data shared. So to be able to do that in a way, then the big companies, you know, like Microsoft and Google and et cetera, will have a service where they will provide that to them. So there's a business model there. And then also you're starting to see it rolled into word processors like, you know, Microsoft Word and Excel and all these things. So you can, or your email, you can be just like, you know, complete this email for me or rewrite this. And some of that is free and it's just built into the operating systems. But some of that will be service oriented, you know, and that will play out in the future. But I think there's, some of these things are useful and people are willing to pay for them. So it's not just like the search, you know, advertisement model thing.
So we're at the advent of the artificial intelligence era, and what that means may ultimately be dependent on how we'd like to see it utilized going forward. And the best uses for AI are still up for debate. So what questions do you have about this technology and how you've seen it used already and would like to see it used in the future? Our guest, Kyle Cranmer, director of UW-Madison's Data Science Institute and professor in the Physics, Computer Science, and Statistics departments. You can join us 1-800-642-1234 or email talk at WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you're listening to WPR News. Tomorrow on the Larry Mueller Show, Larry's making ice cream with the UW-Madison Food Science Department, also looking at the history of cherries in Wisconsin with the Door County Historical Society, and talk about how to preserve their family's most treasured items. Well, all that and more tomorrow with Larry Mueller from 11 to 1. But right now, our guest, Kyle Cranmer, UW-Madison professor in the Physics Department, affiliated also with Computer Sciences and Statistics. He is the director of the Data Science Institute, and we're we're talking about artificial intelligence today and where it's going as we're at the advent of the AI revolution. And here's what I'd like to see, Kyle. You talked about the energy input that goes into these data centers, the water usage. I'd like AI to come up with a way to be energy neutral at least, or find a way to be environmentally friendly in its usage. I'd like AI to find a cure for cancer. I'd like AI to find new items or new ways we can use materials that help, you know, not make things any worse than, you know, how we found them. How can we use AI for these purposes, and what would it mean to get there from here?
Yeah, no, I'm very happy you asked, because, I mean, with all the doom and gloom, you'd be like, why are we doing this at all? And
turn it off! Turn it off!
And I take that all very seriously, but there's certainly an upside and that we should be excited about and is something that, you know, is responsible to look into.
The potential is huge.
Exactly. So I think, you know, like drug discovery is a great example. And actually right now in the Data Science Institute, we're hosting an international group of people that are all thinking about, you know, molecules and things like that. And they're trying to find, for instance, you know, new drugs. So I just listened to a talk right before I walked over here. I was looking at Ebola and trying to figure out a drug that would help, you know, protect us from Ebola. And so they have simulations that they do where you're literally, you know, modeling the different atoms in some protein that the virus of Ebola makes, and watching it jiggle around and do stuff like that. They even have this thing called Fold at Home, where they have computers from, you know, it's like citizen science, people running their computers all around the world that are running these simulations, because it's incredibly hard to have enough computing power to model how these molecules move around and stuff, to know how you could potentially try have another molecule come in, your drug come in to try to, you know, neutralize it. And so machine learning is being really useful at taking all this data from all these like simulations that people from around the world are contributing, and then trying to, you know, look for patterns and glean information from that. And what they showed was that they found that this one thing that Ebola makes, it kind of opens up and closes. This molecule kind of opens and closes. And if they could find something to go in there when it opens up, it would basically shut the whole thing down. And they found some candidate that they think might actually be working. And so machine learning helped find that. And it's something that it's not just AI on its own. It's not language models. It's, you know, scientists working with these tools to try to help them, give them capabilities they didn't have before. Like, we just don't have enough computing to do it in some brute force way. And AI can be very effective at helping us, you know, take information from the simulations that chemists, put in. So it's really domain knowledge, scientific knowledge, pull some of that information out and help us accelerate some of the computational bottlenecks that we have to find, you know, new candidates for drugs. And there's tons and tons of examples for that. The Nobel Prize in Chemistry this last year was for someone that it was similar to, the image creation, where you give it a text prompt and it makes an image. But the prompt wasn't text. It was an insulin molecule. And it said basically find another molecule or protein that would like bind to it. And so instead of making an image of a teddy bear, you're making another molecule. And so that's like very useful. And you can do things like, you know, what would be something that would make me a better battery?
Yes.
Because batteries are super important for like a, you know, clean energy economy and all of these kinds of things. And oftentimes the situation is that the space of possibilities is so big and so vast that it's you just don't know how to search through all these possibilities efficiently. And these generative AI tools are really good at saying, oh, here's a possibility, here's a possibility. And in some sense, hallucinations there are almost good. They're almost like creativity. Like, oh, here's some situation you might not have considered.
Yeah.
But then you need to ground it. You don't want to trust that this hallucinated, you know, oh, here's a new molecule, why don't you inject it and see what happens? You know, you don't want to do that. So, but once you have this new candidate, then you can, you know, make it, synthesize it in a lab and study its properties and do all the kinds of things you would do in the normal, say, drug discovery process. But the way that you got to this candidate has been accelerated. And that's really exciting.
Let's go back to the calls here. I've got tons of questions of my own, but I'm more interested at this point in hearing from you. And we'll go next to Bruce in Madison. Bruce, good morning. You're on the air with Kyle Cranmer, director of the Data Science Institute at UW-Madison.
Hello.
Hi.
I think you were just touching on what I think is an important point, in that we're calling a lot of different things AI when they're really rather different. the types of things that you're using to discover new molecules that'll bind to disease agents and things like that, I think is a little bit different than the large language model. And perhaps we need different words to describe them, because it really confuses people between stuff that is likely to produce junk and stuff that's likely to produce things that are really helpful.
Teddy bears on roller skates versus cure for Ebola.
Yeah, no, I mean, I 100% agree. And it's something that, you know, I talk about even to my colleagues, that this term AI is almost starting to be somewhat meaningless. You know, AI had a somewhat precise definition in the 50s, but then it became more concrete. People used the term machine learning. And then around the 1980s, 2000s, and then around 2012, there was a really big milestone within a subset of machine learning called deep learning. And now language models are even a subset of that. So like a really niche thing, but what they're delivering on, people are just starting to call it AI. So it's kind of the snake eating itself or something. The term is
it's an umbrella. But when you talk about generating new materials for batteries, we talked about Elon Musk's artificial intelligence bot before Grok. But also, I could see where Elon Musk would use artificial intelligence for his own batteries. How do we differentiate between the two in a way that can be beneficial for us all?
Yeah, and I think that the language issue is important. We do need to start to have some more nuanced language. We need to do that in a way that doesn't feel like we're being... like it's overly scholarly or intimidating or elitist or something like that. But we as society need to start to have some slightly more nuanced language so that we can distinguish these different things.
We've got time for one more here, and I apologize. Patty and Madison, we'll go to you. Good morning. Patty?
Oh, yes, I'm here. Sorry. I was just reading about something called mechanistic interpretability, as it's a way to figure out how the AI model, whatever it would be, how it gets to its answers.
I think I know where you're going with that. Yeah, no, it's a great question. So sometimes there's this funny thing where people will be like, AI was so amazing, but no one understands how it works. And that's kind of a funny statement, because of course, like, someone programmed the thing. So so in some sense, of course, people know exactly how it works, but in the low level details. But in terms of like how it's able to do what it does so effectively, can still be somewhat mysterious. And so this interpretability is very important. Question is very important, and it's also related to the, you know, hallucinations and et cetera. And there are a couple of approaches. Sometimes people try to design systems that are a little bit more restricted or made out of, it's not like one big black box. It's got some components that you kind of have responsibilities, and it's a little bit more like an engineered system, and it's easier to kind of diagnose and understand what's going on. There's another one, but oftentimes those systems don't perform quite as well. And then there are these ones where you have like the big black box. And some people have referred to this mechanistic interpretability as like a artificial neuroscience. So the big black box is kind of like, it's sort of thinking, you know, in quotes, and you don't really know exactly how it works. But in the same way that the brain is super complicated, like, can you probe it in some way and try to figure out, you know, how it is that it's working? And so there's a whole subfield that is this kind of artificial neuroscience type thing that's sort of looking at these big neural networks almost like a brain or something and trying to figure out if they can kind of reverse engineer what's happening. It's a really fascinating area, actually.
Patty, I very much appreciate the call, and I want to apologize to everybody else that we didn't get to your questions, because certainly there are a ton of them to be had, and it's something to investigate going forward. And Kyle, I want to thank you, because you've changed the way I've seen artificial intelligence today. It's not just teddy bears on skateboards anymore.
Yeah, no, not at all. Well, thank you very much. It's a great topic, and I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, I hope we have this opportunity again, Kyle. Thank
you
very
thank
much.
You.
Kyle Cranmer is a UW-Madison professor in the physics department with affiliate appointments in computer sciences and statistics. He is also the director of the UW-Madison Data Science Institute. All right, so up next, we take a look at maps and map making with Matthew Edney, director of the History of Cartography Project at UW-Madison. Well, what do you want to know about cartography and how far it goes back thousands and thousands of years, mapping our lands, our seas, and our stars? That's coming up after noon. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you are listening to The Larry Mueller Show. We'll be right back. For almost 50 years now, a team of researchers have assembled a massive and comprehensive multi-volume history of cartography. This global project has taken place just as technology has transformed the practice of map-making as we know it and the way we see our own world. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today on The Larry Mueller Show, and our guest, Matthew Edney, Director of the History of Cartography Project at UW-Madison and Osher Professor in the History of Cartography at the University of Southern Maine. So what questions do you have about maps and map making, those who made them, and how they have changed over the ages? Join our conversation, 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or send us an email to talk@WPR.org. And Matthew, welcome to the Larry Mueller Show.
Thank you for having me.
So let's go back to the year. It was 1977. It was the first Star Wars movie making it on the big screen. It was the advent of the Apple II computer, ushering in a revolution for personal computing. And it was the launch of the Voyager 2 spacecraft. And it was in this year that the History of Cartography project began. Who started it, and what was behind its inception?
Well, it was begun by two gentlemen, a man called David Woodward, who was then at the Newbery Library in Chicago, and he moved up to UW in 1980. And his collaborator, a man called Brian Harley, who was then at the University of Exeter, and he, in 1986, moved to UW-Milwaukee. To be closer to David and the project in Madison. And their idea was a four-volume history of cartography, of map making in all cultures across all periods, that would take four volumes totaling 1 million words and all to be done by 1992. And partly they were, their main concern was to start looking at early maps in a cultural way, to treat maps not just as works of science, they are always works of science, but to also understand them as human works, their social instruments, their cultural documents, and to try to have an international team of writers to rethink and to retell the history of maps as human things. And so our primary funder has always been the National Endowment for the Humanities. Huh. National Science Foundation kicked in a fair bit, but NEH was our primary funder. And so, and this generated such a hugely new way of looking at maps that the volumes themselves grew both in number. So the series, when it's complete, will be six volumes. All but one have been published, and the last one just went to press on Friday.
Oh, wow.
And it will take 2 years for it to appear. It's a very large volume because the volumes themselves have grown. Each of the last four volumes are 1 million words unto themselves. And so it takes a lot to get one of those things through press, through copy editing, layout, and all the rest. So it's going to take 2 years. But in 2027, the last volume, volume five in the 19th century, will be done. And David and Brian's vision will be fulfilled.
And Matthew, you have been the director of this project for the last 22 years. And you said, you know, originally this project was supposed to wrap up in 1992 with four volumes. You've surpassed that, and the final volume is still to come in the next year or two. How have you seen the cartography change over that time and the role that the History of Cartography project has played in it?
You know, it's, well, cartography has changed immensely. I mean, you just can't get away from the fact that the digital revolution has thoroughly and completely changed how we make maps and how people relate to maps. You know, in 1977, you mentioned the Apple II came out. From my point of view, it was the Mac in 1984 that really changes things. So my old advisor, David Woodward, I studied with him in the 80s. In Madison, he was a self-described font freak. He was these people who was really into typeface, you know, walking up State Street. It would be critiquing, you know, that typeface doesn't go with that typeface, you know, that's hideous. But nobody else really cared. But it was the Mac in 1984 that made everybody font freaks. So now everybody has their favorite typeface.
Sure.
Unfortunately, for some people, it's Comic Sans, but you know, take the whole world.
I don't know anybody for whom it's Comic Sans, man.
Oh, it is. It is. There are people out there. Unfortunately. But anyway, but the Mac and the laser printer, which came out of the Park, Xerox PARC Institute, completely revolutionized map making. It brought everything down to the desk. The big mainframe systems of what are called geographic information systems through the 90s got ported down from big mainframes to workstations to desktops. And so now almost anybody, especially if you're using some of the open source software, QGIS in particular, you can make your own maps. And then all these, with the growth of the internet, there are these web-based mapping systems where you don't even need to buy your own and get into the whole hassle of trying to use these very, very complex data systems. You can make your own maps, almost drop of a hat. And so maps have proliferated. And as big data has proliferated, we have more and more access to reliable data sets, both geographical outlines, but also the statistical data about how people live. Mm. We can make all sorts of maps at the drop of a hat. So in many respects, you know, we talk about Web 2.0, for the human interaction of the web. Well, you know, that's cartography 2.0 in a nutshell. And you throw on top of that the rise of satellite imagery,
yep,
which in the 70s was still photographic film loaded into the satellite before launch and then would be dropped down to Earth in little parachute assemblies to be processed. Well, that all went digital in the 80s. And that's generated a whole nother layer of environmental mapping that has just completely revolutionized the environmental sciences. So to look at the 1970s and what mapping was then, you know, when I was a kid in 1980, I went to college, I was going to be a land surveyor. Huh. And the kind of surveying that I learned, I still learned how to do plane tabling. Plane tabling is where you have basically a yard by a yard plank of wood that you put up on a tripod. And you literally sketch the map as you go, as you're looking at the landscape. When in my last year in 1982-83, I got to use a total station, which is laser rangefinder. And so the person behind the surveyor, the surveying process, goes from behind the telescope, the theodolite, where he's looking at various places, and they become the person who's standing there with a little reflector, and they're choosing what sites to pinpoint, and the guy at the telescope is just literally pointing the laser beam to point at that reflector and pressing a button that says measure the time and the angles involved and how that laser beam is going to get to the reflector and back, and that's completely changed how surveyors work as well. Sure. So everything from land surveying, the digital imagery from satellites, the ways we process that information on computers has just completely revolutionized everything to do with mapping.
It's almost hard to fathom. I mean, except unless, of course, you, like Matthew, started with your own yardstick doing your own mapping. And right. I mean, that's how far we've come. And how fast is also a little bit, I would think, would be a challenge when you're trying to document the history of cartography as quickly as it was advancing while you were trying to document it, Matthew.
Well, fortunately, that we end volume 6, which came out in 2015. we end that at about 2000, as we're loose in the ends of each period covered. And all the great, so we miss all the huge internet-driven explosion of mapping, fortunately. I once joked we needed a seventh volume. We should have ended volume 6 about 1980, 1970. And then have a second volume just for digital but
that doesn't sound like too much of a joke, Matthew.
No,
it sounds pretty serious.
Except we didn't have to fund it. So,
well, there are a couple of questions here, and I want to invite folks into the conversation with our guest, the direct longtime history of cartography project director, Matthew Edney, and how maps have changed the way we've seen the world and how maps themselves have changed just in our lifetime. 1-800-642-1234 is the phone number to join us, 1-800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org. We'll start with Margo in Madison. Margo, good afternoon.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Thank you. I just had a comment. GPS is great. I mean, you know, you're out someplace and you don't have to be lost. That's wonderful. But I really am concerned about, especially the young people, growing up without having to learn to navigate an actual map. I mean, when you have the thing in your hands and you're there in the car and you're navigating for the driver, you have to understand north, south, east, west. You have to understand how the interstate system runs across the country and they're numbered in different ways for north, south, east, and west. You have to understand about crossing county lines and you have to understand about bridges that may be out. And you have to learn about the topography of the land that you are in at that moment. And with GPS, you never have that context. And that affects your brain, too, how you think things through, how you plan ahead, how you problem solve. And without maps, I feel like we're losing all of that, aside from the history of what isn't there anymore. So that was just my comment, but I understand everybody's love of GPS.
Well, I mean, Margo, you make me miss the old Rand McNally Atlas that you keep in the back of the car. And also, you know, the times when you do get lost, you don't even have the chance to get lost anymore. But in the bigger picture of things, how these maps change the way we think, or perhaps with the advent of GPS, how we don't have to, Matthew.
Well, I think, Margaret, thank you for your comments. I mean, this is a really important question, and I think it is definitely changing, along with all sort of other ways in which digital technologies are changing how we learn and how we think about the world. But one thing I think you have to be aware of is that GPS and associated mapping practices have actually enabled much more use of navigational tools than there was before. In the paper map, yeah, we had the Rand McNally atlases, or, you know, I've been living in Maine since 95, where we have the DeLorme company, which made by state-by-state gazetteers, and everybody in Maine had their favorite gazetteer in the back seat of the car. So when I started in 95, and I asked my students here, how many of you have the state gazetteer, you know, on the back seat of the car? And they would say, you know, about half of my classes would say, yeah, we got it. And they annotate them, you know, with all their favorite swimming holes and fishing points and all the rest. Now I do that, and one person out of 100 might say, yeah, I've got that. And they've all shifted to GPS. So I think on the one hand, there's a massive change in practice. But it's a massive change in practice that hides the fact that so many more people are able to navigate now than they could before.
But is navigation the same? I mean, as...
Oh, no, navigation is not the same. I mean, Margot's point that you're not looking at a map to figure out the best route, and that helps you, that act of inquiring, of investigating the map, helps you memorize the route and helps you understand space. That's lost, by and large, except for those nerds like me who don't use GPS because I want to look at the map, and maybe a map on a screen. But, you know, I was driving around southern Wisconsin last Saturday and looking for bookstores. And my wife, who is directionally challenged, God bless her, was using the GPS to give me instructions. And she sent me the wrong way. And rather than going towards Mineral Point, we ended up by the Mississippi. And
oh, my.
Like, yeah, we went the wrong way. And if I'd been doing it, we wouldn't have done it, but I was driving, so she was navigating. Anyway, there's absolutely a change in practice, but there's also a democratization of practice. So as long as the GPS and Google Maps or Apple Maps, open source map are free, then anybody can use them. Anybody can access them to navigate. In the same way that now everybody can write. You know, we have all these mechanisms that allow people to write and to get their voice out that you didn't have unless you ran a underground zine or something. You know, the blogs and the internet now have dramatically democratized the ability to get our word out in the same way as democratized our way to understand space. It's just changed the ways we think about space. I will say that for me, teaching old maps and my own research is primarily 18th century. When you're looking at these copper plate engraved maps with beautifully engraved handwriting that my students nowadays have a really hard time with because nobody learned cursive at school anymore. So there's a point where we've got to go through the cursive process.
Yeah.
The technology is wonderful, but it definitely has its downsides from an historian's point of view.
Matthew Edney is our guest. He is the longtime director of the History of Cartography Project at UW-Madison, almost 50 years old and still going on, with its latest volume expected to be published in the next couple of years. If you have questions about the map making and the history of it and how it's changed and revolutionized, not just the way we see our world, but the way we think and process where we are in it, join us, 1-800-642-1234. Colleen, we'll get to you next, 800-642-1234, or talk at WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you're listening to WPR News. Hey, if you're missing Larry today and would like to hear a little more of him, you can always listen to our archives anytime at your leisure at WPR.org/Larry. Larry's back tomorrow, but I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and our guest is the longtime director of the History of Cartography Project at UW-Madison, Matthew Edney. And we're taking a look at how maps have changed over the years and how they changed us in the way we see the world. Conversations available, questions, comments, 1-800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org. Let's go to Colleen in Green Bay. Colleen, good afternoon.
Hi. I'm a retired social studies teacher, and I just think maps are great. I always had a map of the week. I had 6th, 7th, and 8th graders, so I went through 3-year cycle. So all my kids, you know, had a different map for 3 years, you know, every week. And the point I'm trying to make is that I think maps give kids a perspective about where they've been or where they're going as far as the land, what rivers. Like in Wisconsin, a lot of the roads that were created were old Indian trails. You know, the highways were created. And, you know, because there's a river here or there's a certain, you know, in the greater part of the United States, a mountain there. And the kids aren't getting that now. I was driving with some people that were like 30 years younger than I was, and I said, they were listening to GPS, and I said, turn here, and they ignored me. and I said, no, really, this is a shortcut. This is going to save us like 20 minutes. And they didn't believe me. I said, I have driven this so many times. They didn't believe me because GPS was telling them to keep going straight. And people are not understanding, you know, spatial directions. They're not getting spatial intelligence. They're losing out, I think, on higher level thinking skills. As a kid, I was the navigator. I would look at the maps. I would help my grand, you know, we'd drive from Green Bay to Florida, sure, or wherever it was. And as the oldest, I got to do the maps. I think that's why I fell in love with maps. But I just really think that the younger people are really losing out. I never use GPS. I'll go online now, look at a map. I'll write down the directions. I'll print out MapQuest maybe, but, I don't need GPS.
I had to laugh, Colleen, because I have certainly been in a car where the algorithm has won out over the expert before. And once we got to where we were going, pretty clear that the expert probably had a better route, but also the bigger picture, again, reiterating, Matthew, how these maps are changing us, but also not just where we're going, but a way to document where we've been and an understanding of where we've been.
Oh, sure. And at this point, I think, and thank you, Colleen, for your point. I do love the idea of printing out MapQuest pages. That's what I used to do. until I got horribly lost in Newark, which is the seventh circle of hell, is Newark, driving around Newark Airport, you know. I gave up on even on MapQuest at that point. But the thing about maps are, is that we've, in a modern society, and especially with computer, I think both Clean and Margot intimate this, we come to treat maps, they might not, but people they know do, as if they are somehow, you know, almost God-given, that they're factual statements about the nature of the Earth. But maps have always been made as human documents for human use. And maps tend to show not so much what the world is, but what the world should be, or what the world ought to be, from the point of view of the makers. So the boundaries are those of the making community, not those recognized by people on the ground. Same thing with place names. The way that you represent towns is going to vary based on your perspective. There's a wonderful scholar out of Johns Hopkins, like Richard Kagan, who did this amazing work on Renaissance city views and plans. And he really argues for both an external and an internal perspective. The city is going to look differently if you're making it as a member of that city, of the corporation and the guilds or religious houses, as it would be from outside if you're a royal officer who's going to come in and assess it for fortifications or taxes or whatever it may be. And then what are you trying to actually map and capture? Are you trying to map the built environment, or are you trying to map the city as a community in the way, you know, the Puritans talked about the city upon the hill they're going to build when they came to New England? And whether you're mapping the urban place, the built environment, or the sense of what's called the civitas, the community, you end up with different kinds of visualizations. And so you have one axis of built to community, and another axis of internal, external. And the result is you can start to fill in this kind of space of knowledge and think, well, you've got straight topographic plans, which are very factual, very external. Nobody inside Madison is, for example, if you're a Madison resident, you're going to sit down and make a map of Madison as if it's a topographic plan. But an outside surveyor will, who's mapping for federal government or the state government, as opposed to a member of a community who's mapping the social community by being part of a parade. And we find that there's very, you know, very set defined routes that parades take or festivals take, and sequences in which people move in these festivals, these parades, which help define the nature of the community. They help define the space, the communal space of the town, if not the geographical space. And these things are going on today.
Sure.
Maybe not in Madison. I mean, the Fête de Marquette was rained out last week. I was going to go there, but no, I couldn't. It rained out. Anyway, but they are being they do still take place in all the Saints' Day parades around the world, for example. And these are kinds of maps that are not graphic maps; they're performative maps. But they're the kind of maps that even modern societies do on a routine basis, that might get ignored in the quest to be very factual and very scientific.
Colleen also brought up something that I'm curious how the History of Cartography Project has incorporated in their work, and that is Native American roads and how indigenous mapping was used.
Indigenous mapping is a really hot topic. Not very many people are doing it because it's difficult to properly negotiate the politics of working with indigenous groups, and taking what are often internal documents to those indigenous peoples. In the past, you could just blithely disseminate this work, but nowadays we have to be sensitive that this is to the needs and the wishes of the groups. But we actually have a whole separate volume, Volume 2, Book 3, which was published in 1998, and it is freely available. If you don't want to buy it, there are plenty of copies left. But you can also download it for free, all the chapters, from the University of Chicago Press website. In fact, you can do that with all the published volumes. So, good plug. But if you look at Volume 2, Book 3, this is about the indigenous mapping within the historic record around the world. So we have information about Native American mapping and First Nations mapping in North America, Aztec and Incan Amazonian mapping in South America, stuff about pre-imperial Africa, Aboriginal Australia, and so on. And then you've got the larger traditional societies of Asia, which are the subjects of Volume 2, 1 and 2, Book 2, pre-imperial, pre-European colonization of India and Southwest Asia and East Asia, have very, very active and vibrant mapping practices. And so, the history of cartography volumes have stimulated a huge amount of new research, especially among scholars in China and Japan and India, about their own mapping traditions. So the work that we've done, it was before my time as director, has stimulated so much new work that it's really making the study of maps truly international, truly global.
Matthew Edney, our guest, he is the longtime director of the History of Cartography Project at UW-Madison. Let's go to Ruth in Chippewa Falls next. Ruth, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I've been traveling on my own before they had GPS, and I was thrilled to see that I didn't have to do it blindly. So I got a GPS. Well, let me tell you, don't go anywhere without a map, and don't go without looking before you leave, because the GPS will lead you down the merry path.
It is not all-knowing omniscient, is what you're saying, Ruth.
I'm saying it has told me in a cul-de-sac to go off-road.
Well, I'm glad you didn't listen to it.
You know, there are these are really good points, because the data that GPS is using are created by humans, which means there are failure points all the way through the creation of these data sets. The data set, just because they're digital, just because they're maps, doesn't mean that they're utterly trustworthy. And so the number of times people have been directed to turn left out of, you know, there's a not too many fords in this country, but in Europe, there's lots of fords where the river goes through, the road goes through the river. And GPS keeps telling people, turn right and go along the riverbed in the water, you know, which is not very good. That's because the system has not been created as robustly as it could have been, because much of this data is actually coming from paper maps.
Oh, interesting.
The data is not purely digital born. It's getting more so. But so, for example, we mentioned MapQuest. Colleen mentioned MapQuest earlier. MapQuest and then after at Google, the core data for the United States came from maps that had been digitized by the U.S. Census Bureau to keep track of census districts, blocks, block groups, and tracts. And their maps came from each state. So some states had really, really detailed and very precise maps to keep track of the census districts. And some states had less. They didn't put as much money in. And then the maps, these paper maps, are then digitized by the Census Bureau so they could start doing digital mapping of census returns. But they started selling off all the data. And so MapQuest and other people took it and then did a whole bunch of ground truthing. This is where the driving around and testing the data, is the digital data actually any good? And the testing doesn't necessarily go down every single street. And so you're left with a very variable data set. Now, over the 90s, 2000s, 2010s, that data has been progressively gotten better. But other parts of the world are not based on that, even that kind of data. They're based on digital data, satellite imagery that are being digitized by hand or by computer algorithm, which may or may not be accurate. And as a result, there's all sorts of errors creep in.
Yeah.
So I'm up there with Ruth. Take a map.
But I let's continue with the questions here, because we continue to add them on, and I'm curious to get your answer, Matthew. John in Madison, we'll go to you next. Good afternoon.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. I'm an educator based in Madison, and I agree with a lot of the concerns about digitization that callers have talked about, myself included, who've lost navigation skills as I've aged. But I also think about the possibilities, one of which is related to the issue of time, the temporality. A lot of the exciting mapping I see now and in the future, you know, allows a map not just to be spatial, you know, but to think about each map we see as representing a point in time. Hmm. And that, you know, the dream could be to rewind and fast forward the spatial landscape and help kids and all people, you know, kind of see how the landscape is changing. And I wonder if your guest could kind of talk about that possibility and how he thinks about, you know, maybe a future volume of cartography. We think about it, you know, not just as a spatial profession, but a spatial temporal profession, and what the implications of that might be.
Yeah, John, that is a perfect question for the director of the History of Cartography Project. Matthew?
It's brilliant. That's a great question. Yeah. Thank you, John. So, well, one initial point, and I'll get back to John's particular idea, is an idea that's embedded in a lot of modern 20th century, 21st century ideas about maps, that maps are correct only for the moment when they are made. Mm-hmm. As an historian, I can say that there is maps get used for as long as they are useful. And the question of what is useful is not really necessarily related to the content. So a map can be in use for sometimes hundreds of years, even though the conditions have changed. But the idea of taking maps and animating them, in effect, to show time, we've been trying to do that really since the 70s and 80s. There were people playing with VCR systems and then laser discs, you know, now's all just straight digital files, trying to take data and get them in a way that we can then show how they change over time. This is really a fun area. I mean, anybody who does map making now will tell you that once you get the data into the right format, then the digital creation of the map is really quite straightforward. It might be an overnight processing or something like that. It's just that getting the data into the right shape so you can do that can take weeks and months. I mean, that's the hard part, is taking varieties of data sets and getting them into the right format so they all align with each other properly, so you can then make a map. That's the real hard part. And if you then add the temporal dimension, not only do we have to get all these different data sets from now to talk to each other, but we also have to get all the data sets from the past, such as they may be. That then adds a level of complexity to the data processing that I think can be really hard to overcome. And then there's the fact of, well, what kind of maps are you working with from the past? Let's say if you want to do a retrospective map, and there are maps, there's some very nice time-lapse maps have been done, for example, showing the growth of the Roman Empire over time and then its collapse, the history of the boundaries of France or the Roman Empire that becomes Germany, those kinds of things. And there's also some very interesting work being done on a much smaller time scale, looking at environmental change. There are some maps in the 18th, even the 17th century, that are really well surveyed of very small parts of the world, parts of coastlines, parts of rivers, and you can start looking at those over time. And in fact, urban historians have done a lot of this with 18th, 19th, and 20th century mapping, where you can see the growth of cities as they've grown and restructured themselves with railroads, especially with trolley cars, and then later on with the automobile and the motorway and airports, you start to get interesting reconstructions of cities. And you can do that over time, and it has been done in a variety of ways. Whether you can actually create an animation for somebody to see, or one of my favorites is to take, a lot of systems do this, you can take two early maps, or an early map and a modern map, and then with a slider, you sort of, as you move the slider back and forth across the screen, you go from the old to the new. And so you can see change between the old, what it used to be like and what it is now. All these things are possible and really quite straightforward once you've got the data into the right system.
Yeah. And John, I appreciate the call. The other question is, with the final volume expected to be published over there, going to the publishers just on Friday, Matthew, of the History of Cartography, what would be the future of this project?
It has no future beyond the publication of the last volume. It was created to print, to produce the History of Cartography series, and that is what it's doing.
Where would you like it to see this research go from here? Where, what's the, well, how does it move forward?
So the series, as I said at the beginning, when David Woodward and Brian Harley began this, the idea was to get people to think about maps in a human way, as human works. And that's been undeniably its effect across the board. If you're studying early maps, you're studying early maps in the universe created by the History of Cartography project. But at the same time, the way that people have studied maps has they've almost like slingshot past the history. The history, it's taken a long time to get the history project to where it is now. And the field has moved very much ahead. So the future influence, I think, a future benefit of this series is only going to become apparent when volume 5 is actually published, because it actually fills the gap between 4 and 6, between the Enlightenment in 4 and the 20th century in volume 6. But it has the same design as those two volumes. And so finally, we'll actually be able, people will be able to read across the volumes by looking at the history of property mapping, as opposed to marine charting, as opposed to regional mapping, as opposed to atlas production, as opposed to military map making and use, as opposed to the commercial map trade. We can start looking actually at the history of cartography as it's been practiced, as it's changed over the last three centuries. And that's something we just haven't really been doing, because we haven't had the framework to do it. There's just, people look at the field and they're just blown away by the amount of data that's available. And so everyone's been really happy, and I'm as guilty as anybody else of going in and looking at one map or a set of maps and really working through how this set of map work, how it had influence, how people related to the maps, the history of those maps themselves, political importance or social importance or technical importance at that moment. Now the task is to sit back and actually understand, to really come to terms with the history of mapping rather than the history of cartography, if that makes sense.
Matthew Edney, our guest, director of the History of Cartography Project at UW-Madison, also OSHA professor in the History of Cartography at the University of Southern Maine. And we've still got time for your questions at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us, talk@WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you're listening to WPR News. Tomorrow on the Larry Mueller Show, Larry's making ice cream with the UW-Madison Food Science Department. We're looking at the history of cherries in Door County with the Door County Historical Society and finding the best way to help preserve your family treasures. All with Larry tomorrow on the Larry Mueller Show from 11 to 1 here on WPR News. A reminder, if you are interested in the multiple volumes of the History of Cartography Project, they are freely available to everybody online at press.uchicago.com. chicago.edu/books/HOC. Okay, that might be a mouthful, so we've just thrown it up at WPR.org/Larry with the today's episode. So after the show today, you can find that link at WPR.org/Larry. Our guest, Matthew Edney, longtime director of the History of Cartography Project at UW-Madison. And before we took a break there, Matthew, you were talking about the difference between cartography and mapping. And lay that out for us. What is it?
Well, to be honest, I mean, it's rather ironic that here I am as director of the History of Cartography Project. And cartography itself is actually really an idealization. There's no such thing as cartography. I started my last book with a chapter one epigraph. There's no such thing as cartography, and this is a book about it. stealing from a historian of science who wrote that about the scientific revolution. What we think we do is cartography, but what we actually do is mapping. pardon me. We have an idea that cartography and maps are just, maps are all the same. Maps are all replications, reductions of the Earth's surface, and they're factual and technical and scientific. But in reality, the way that we think about the world differs based on our need. So when we think about property, we think about boundaries in the landscape. And the landscape itself doesn't necessarily have to have relief or anything like that. What's important is area and taxable value and ownership. And so there's a whole kind of mapping that is made of property, real property, as opposed to communal property, which has a different kind of mapping, that's all about establishing boundaries and calculating areas and taxing them, as opposed to military mapping, which is all about landscape as relief, as a continuous surface, as crinkly, that has valleys and hills, cliffs, trees, water, places that you can put troops and places where you can't, especially pre-aerial technologies. And so military mapping is a different kind of mapping. It looks at the landscape in a different kind of way to different ends, as opposed to the geographer, as we think of them in the past, who are sitting around in a studio, in an office, taking data from various parts of the world and making maps of the world or maps of continents, as opposed to astronomers who are making maps of the heavens.
Right.
As opposed to the geologist or the sociologist who are making analytical maps, thematic maps of geology or population or class or whatever it may be. And so each one of these different kinds of mapping, different ways of mapping, when you look in the historical record, you start to see that different functions of mapping are entailed with different institutions, both of producing and consuming and using the maps. And they entail different technologies of making and reproducing and accessing the maps. And so in practice, as an academic, rather than just thinking, oh, maps are all the same, as an historian who's trying to understand how maps work within human society and how they shape human thought and how humans use them to do things and to change the world, then the first thing we have to do is to set aside our modern preconceptions and really look at the different modes of mapping, different ways in which people make maps and use maps. And when you do that, then the history of cartography becomes quite different. It's not just this single narrative of ever better technology, ever more data, ever more accurate data, but it becomes a history of, well, it becomes a history of humanity, how people engage with the world, how they change the world, how they understand the world, how they tell other people about the world, but always for that particular reason. Maps are always made for a purpose.
It's almost like a philosophical document about how we see ourselves in the world we're living in that moment. I appreciate that. I want to get to Michael and Madison here before we run out of time. Michael, good afternoon.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I want to say that I am a map enthusiast. I have hundreds and hundreds of maps.
Oh, wow.
Of all different parts of the country, but particularly Wisconsin and Dane County where I live.
Cool.
And when I heard the topic, I thought, what if I had to pick my three favorite maps, if I have any, that would include an early map of California where the Baja Peninsula is outlined as an island rather than a peninsula. Huh. Second would be the eastern part of Tennessee was once slated to become another state named after Ben Franklin. And there are maps that show that, and it's the state was to be called Franklinia. And then coming back to Wisconsin, Iowa County in the southern part of the state it's always been Iowa County as far as I know, but there is a map with an error where Iowa County is labeled as Montgomery County. And that's just a pure simple error. There's no historical relevance to that, but those are hard maps to find. And I just absolutely love maps. And I thank you again for taking my call. I'll listen for the discussion.
Well, before you go, Michael, I'm wondering where the Iowa County, Montgomery County map came from, because that would, who was responsible for such an egregious error?
You know, I can't tell you for sure. I mean, I haven't looked at my map collection in a long time, because I'm actually a compulsive collector. I collect books and microscopes and all the art and all different kinds of stuff.
The state of Franklinian, the island of the California Baja, and the Montgomery County of Wisconsin. Those are unique maps. And Matthew, I imagine you probably have some of your own that are your favorites.
I do. And I should actually just say, California as an island is a long-running idea.
Oh, wow.
It's actually not just Baja California. It's everything up to San Francisco and the Golden Gate. Because some guys in Europe in about 1670 had this idea, well, we got the Colorado River and you got the Golden Gate, and maybe they're actually connected. So everything from San Francisco south becomes this island that is rejoined by the French in about 1700.
Wow. And the
whole story about that. I have, as I like to say to my students and colleagues, I have many favoritist maps. But I think of all the, I have two favoritist maps, most favoritist maps. One is there's a early map of the coast of what becomes New England by John Smith of Pocahontas fame and, you know, all that stuff. After Virginia, he did a brief expedition in 1614 to what is now New England, and he made a map. And that's one of my favorites because I got three peer-reviewed articles and a book out of it. So clearly it says something to me, mostly how badly people have interpreted it, which requires a whole new interpretation. But my really absolute all-time favoritist map, favoritist of all the favoritist maps, is a map made by Mark Twain in September 1870, when the Prussians are about to invest Paris. At the high point of the Franco-Prussian War, Emperor Louis has been captured at Verdun, and the French army is just a complete mess. It's when the Commune rises up, and all sorts of things are going on. And it's a very long story. Mark Twain decides to mock these incredibly ornate and precise maps of the defenses of Paris that are appearing in the New York newspapers. And in his own newspaper, the Buffalo Explorer, to print this absurdist map, which is even more absurd because he cut it in a wood block. He cut the block right reading, so it looked right to him as he cut it. Because when it printed wrong reading, so all the text is incorrect.
Matthew, I apologize. Yeah. We're just about out of time here, but I want to thank you, and what a perfect way to land with Mark Twain's backwards map that was printed for his paper and others. Just a fascinating way to see the world through the history of cartography, Matthew. Thank you for sharing it with us today.
You're entirely welcome. Thank you.
Matthew Edney is the longtime director of the History of Cartography Project at UW-Madison, as well as a professor in the history of cartography at the University of Southern Maine. And thank you for being a part of the show today. It's a team effort, as always, with our producers Clara Neipert and Joel Patenaud, our technical director Jeff Robbins, our executive producer is Jill Nadeau, and I'm Lee Rayburn in today for, of course, Larry Mueller. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show.